Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This panel discussion, moderated by Matthew Skinner, includes Jared Alcantara, Kenyatta Gilbert, Joy J. Moore, and Andrew Root.
Well, good morning again, and welcome to our Wednesday morning panel discussion. My name is Matt Skinner. I teach New Testament at Luther Seminary. I also serve as the Scholar for Adult Education at Westminster Presbyterian Church in downtown Minneapolis. And it's my pleasure and responsibility this morning to moderate a discussion with our three keynote preachers and with Andy Root, who you just heard from if you were on during the previous hour. But our preachers are all here. By way of reminder, in case you had to miss a session, we have Jared Alcantara, we've got Kenyatta Gilbert, and we've got Joy Moore, who hasn't preached yet, but is coming up roughly 1 hour from now, where she will be preaching in our concluding worship service. So welcome all four of you. Thank you for your contributions so far. I'm going to not introduce you any further because time is limited, and I assume people have your bios available to them if they want. But I want to jump right in and talk a bit, create some conversation around some topics that I think preachers are contending with and opportunities that they're walking into right now. And I want to start with an image about the current pandemic. This is way back in April, when the world was just beginning to feel really upended for most of us. The Indian activist and novelist Adarunthai Roy used the image of a portal to describe the pandemic, saying, in light of all of the disruption, all of what the pandemic is illuminating in terms of systemic injustices and everything else about what used to be normal, she said, the pandemic provides an opportunity to pass through a portal or a gateway from our former lives into what's next. And we can carry everything with us with the hope that we can continue life just the way it was, or our practices or our ways of using our time just the way we did. Or we can carry a much lighter load. There's an opportunity available to us. Of course, the portal that we're walking through takes a while to get through, as we're all realizing. But I wonder, when it comes to the craft of preaching, you know, the way we prepare our sermons or the priorities that we bring to the preaching enterprise and the strategic thinking that centers around preaching, what do you recommend preachers should be leaving on this side of the portal in terms of their own practices or their own priorities? I'm not talking about national policies or social structures, but preachers in their own ways of organizing their lives and their weeks, what should they leave behind? Joy Moore was the first to smile when I asked the question, which means I'm going to invite her to answer first.
But this is my party. We were supposed to ask the guest first.
You showed the most like register on your face. So that's on you.
That's on me. Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And my students will recognize this phrase from me. And it is to leave behind telling folks what to do or how to think, and to invite them to invite them into the story of the biblical story, the biblical narrative, in such a way that they recognize that they can enact the drama that is being told. Sometimes what we do in our preparation is, I know for myself, and in fact, I'm even guilty of this in my sermon, where I know where I want to go, and I don't, as Kenyatta mentioned the other day, I don't follow that inductive journey to bring the listeners along. And when we do that and we make a shift into this new portal, or we go through this portal, we've got rules that have no place in the new reality. If we taught folks how to live out the story, then they can, like a jazz player, kind of shift given the new reality. If all we've done is given them rules and principles, we've actually left them without tools for today.
Thanks. Anybody ready to go next? Kenyatta's leaning forward. I'm just saying, body language matters on Zoom.
Oh, gosh.
First of all, it's good to see everyone. Thank you again, Luther Seminary and leadership, for inviting me to participate. I guess to that question, I think we should leave behind much of the tradition that sort of plagues the psyche. So I feel like this is an opportunity for us to come back to ourselves in some ways. Well, I'm really primarily speaking for myself, who I've not left home very much, and I've had to recreate some things at home that remind me of a sense of being with the people in the congregation. But rediscovering that it's just as important to sit with God, to establish one's relationship in ways in which would prepare us for the next normal. I wouldn't say, you know, I think that that's where we're headed. We're headed for contemplating what things might look like beyond our COVID reality, and whether or not we are prepared to engage a new reality with faith.
Jared, Andy?
Yeah, I thought of a couple things. One, I was reminded of a Dallas Willard line, the call to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from our lives. In some ways, due to, you know, restrictions and protocols, pastors who might have been relentlessly hurried and harried have to rethink what it looks like to do ministry. That can be a means of grace if we would let it. I know one of my struggles is with, it depends on how you're made or your personality type and so on, but there's this dialectic of aloneness and community, and Bonhoeffer warns against each extreme. So those who are always alone, mm-hmm. and are afraid of community are tempted in certain ways, and those who are always in community and never alone would be tempted in other ways. And so I think there's some opportunity, there's some space for a growth in our own walk with God. Enoch walked with God and didn't walk for God. So sometimes we walk for God and don't walk with God. So I think that's one space, one idea. I think another idea for what we could leave behind on this side of the portal, if you will, would, this isn't the case in every homiletical tradition of every expression of Christianity, but in some traditions, there's very much of a focus on a lecture and on explanation over proclamation. So I return to the Tom Long line from Monday that no news is bad news in a Christian sermon. So what would it look like and sound like to proclaim afresh, even in the midst of suffering and despair and hopelessness, to remain resiliently hopeful while also committing to truth-telling. So both and, not either or, truth-telling and hope-bringing. But to if we're in a format where there's much more of a focus on lecture-style explanation, those who have gotten used to preaching on video realize that time can move a lot more slowly when you're preaching to a green dot for yourself and then for those who are watching you via video. So those are just some thoughts, just some reflections based on that question.
Thanks. Andy.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Jared said is kind of where I would go too. I mean, I hope that what we can leave behind in some sense is, well, first of all, the sense that hurried action or accelerated action is the best form of action. I mean, I think there's a way that kind of pastoral, that we form everyone in our society, but particularly I think pastors, that the pastor who expends the most energy is the best pastor. And so, because when you expend the most energy, you have the best opportunity to harvest the most resources. And the church that will survive is the church with the most resources. And I think there's going to be a great temptation to go back to that as soon as this opens up. And I think it would be wise for us to think even more deeply about what is faithful action? What does faithful pastoral action look like? And it isn't, I don't think, in a having mode, like we need to have more people, we need to have more programs, but I think it's more of a being mode, I think is what, I think we've all kind of touched on that. So, and that's going to take a different kind of formation, I think, which will be really important. I hope we can also maybe think a little bit. I mean, this is a hard thing, especially where we're at right now with what's happened in the last few weeks. But I think it would be good for us to leave behind some of the illusions of late modernity that we're invincible, in that death is not something to talk about, and or that it's done behind kind of perfectly white walls in a hospital that's completely sanitized. And I don't know how we do that, but and that's a tricky thing, but do we remember that the human being is fundamentally a vulnerable creature, and that death is always near, and that the preached word has to say something to that vulnerability of just being the kind of creature who can get a virus and die, and you can't control that, or all the other realities that can happen within that. So that's what I'd say.
I want to invite you all to follow up on each other as well. I don't have to be the only one asking questions here or building. Anybody want to respond to something somebody else has just said?
Just a quick word to what Andy said. When I was in Honduras a couple of years ago, visiting family, someone in my family, an uncle that I love very much, passed away. And the oldest daughter in the family said to her mother, his wife, "Dame la ropa de mi papá." So give me my father's clothes. And immediately they washed him and dressed him. And my aunt changed into her mourning dress. There was no embalming. So someone would be buried within 2 days or 3 days at the latest. And the visitation began that day. That's a very different process. There's a reluctance of fear that points to a deep wound in our society. I think that would be especially important. So I just want to echo what Andy's saying, that you have two preachers competing, death and the preacher, and the preacher's responsibility is to decide who are people going to listen to in the face of death. I'm paraphrasing another Tom Long quote there. With the idea of who we are being and not just having, I'm reminded of Kenyatta Gilbert's father, who was a pastor, who said that 75% of your sermon is the life that you live. So what are we showing people? If anything, this has exposed for many people what's most important, hopefully. So what's most important? Sometimes we'll get it backwards, like we need to make disciples, but we don't focus much on being disciples in order to make disciples. So this could be a place where we have to do some difficult interior work, not just interior work. We need to focus on practices of exteriority as well. But again, there's that dialectic. Sometimes we'll only focus on practices of exteriority, and there'll be hell under the hood, if you will. There'll be lots of problems underneath the surface that we fail to address.
Kenyatta, are you going to jump in there?
No. I'm going to wait for the next question.
I'm just going to just say a little bit in response to the idea of the being, Andy, and just when you were saying that, I was thinking of a question that came up during your presentation. Linda, I think, was the name of the person that put it up, and the comment was, that things have changed, and I think the question was whether or not secularity is the way to name it, and said, hasn't the church failed to meet people's needs? And I think in some ways, when we stop being in a moment when the reality of death, the reality of our fragility is right before us, we stop being because we begin to speak about something out there, ignoring the pain, the loss, the confusion, the vulnerability in this present moment. And so I guess to circle that back to the way that Matt asked the question, our preaching must capture even that moment of loss of control, the reality of our mortality, and not just a word that says don't worry because everything will be better by and by, but how do I live with an authentic hope in the fragility of the moment, so that living into what Kenyatta's dad said, my life is itself a testimony to that hope. Even if I have cancer, even if I have COVID, even if I've lost my mom. So the being, I think, is really important in that answer.
It strikes me that one of the things that makes that difficult right now is it's my life is lived so privately in so many ways. Mm-hmm. Right? It's the professional connections, there's ecclesial connections, but for the most part, my circle of influence feels so much smaller than it ever did. Whether that's true or not, I'm not even really sure because it's so hard to get feedback.
Matt, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, please.
Spoke too soon. So what I'd like to say, and this is particularly true in evangelical traditions, is also leaving behind this sense of celebrity where in the context of worship, the preacher often feeds off the people and their responses. So the antiphonal aspect of worship is in many ways removed in this virtual environment. So having to make adjustments to one's signature approaches to preaching and thinking about what does it mean to preach in one's office to a screen we rendered sermons that were pre-recorded in this space, I couldn't see you. And so, you know, sometimes we take for granted that the people are going to be there. They're going to engage us in response. And that's not necessarily something we can take for granted now.
All right, I'm going to jump in again, if you let me.
This is about all of you talking, so go right ahead.
Because that made me think of, and I'm trying to look, I made a note, and I don't remember who it was, but somebody asked a question or posted a question about, it was Julie, about the yearning for transcendence. Mm-hmm. And that I thought about that, Kenyatta, as you were saying, and actually, as you were speaking too, Matt, because on one level, the privacy and individuality of living alone is heightened. But then we have this capacity to reach all these strangers, to all these people who we may never be in the same zip code with. Mm-hmm. And that's happened to the pulpit. In the sense where the privacy of our gathered congregation, the people we pastor, the folks in our neighborhood whose names we know, has now become, I can get on your Facebook link and watch your sermon. So how do we speak a word that has that kind of public witness that is not so narrow, but is so relevant to complete strangers? And so the longing for transcendence question made me think of, isn't that exactly what Hollywood does in its forming stories? Is that they know people, they know us in general, and they tap into the real hungers and hurts and hopes. And that might be where the church has failed, is because we've named your hunger is for salvation. Well, what does salvation look like? You know, it can't simply be, I'm sorry, I believe in Jesus, save me. It's got to be something that meets me at the place where, I'm going to go there again, at the place where I'm most broken, at the place where I'm most vulnerable, at the place where I have the least amount of control. And when we speak that in such a way that I'm inviting complete strangers from across the cultural, philosophical, national boundaries to join into a story of a God who sees you and loves you in a way that causes folks to lean in and say, tell me more of that. I think we capture the mystery and the majesty of what a proclamation should truly be.
I think that comment leads nicely into the next question I wanted to ask, which pulls on some of these themes from the last hour as well. One of the things the pandemic is doing is it's making people report that their faith is getting stronger. Mm-hmm. This is some of their, at least back in April, there was some Pew research around this. And this is true even for people who don't identify as a regular attender or a member in an institutional faith community of some kind. So there's this interest in spirituality that's popping up. There's at-home practices in practicing the faith are changing. As you noted, Joy, we're having the potential to connect more widely with people. In some ways, preaching might be more intimate if it's me in a room talking to the green dot on my computer. How might preachers take notice of that, take account of that, this idea that for some, at least, the pandemic is a time of incredibly heightened spirituality or spiritual interest? And again, it seems to cut across denominations. It cuts across different religions as well. Thoughts on that? Does that change how a preacher should approach their work?
I went first last time, so I don't have to.
You got your card. You got a card you can play. Why don't we start with Andy? Because that, in some ways, might connect to what you were just talking about in your keynote.
I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think that people probably do feel like there's a kind of renewed or new spiritual impulse that's there. I think building off of Taylor, as I did in my last presentation, that the kind of secular age that he wants to talk about us being in, that, you know, there's a certain response to earlier theoretical perspectives that said, well, no, we're really in a post-secular age because we see all these renewed forms of spirituality. And he actually affirms that very much so, that in this time where organized forms of religion, and in some ways the preacher becomes less important, or maybe not less important, but there becomes other contested ways for people to find meaning, that what explodes is what he calls the synova effect. And there's all sorts of third ways that exist. And I think what happened in the pandemic is that people were slowed down enough that all those third options for spirituality were there. So you never really could do yoga before, or you never even really listened to your, you never really even had time to listen to your Apple Watch when it told you to breathe, but now you could. And that's done something. So there is an opening there, I think, for kind of classic forms of Christian faith and preaching. And I do think people are on Facebook sites and finding out from friends where to jump into a service. But I think it also points to the way that there's just kind of the plurality of spiritual experiences that are there too. So it has an opening, but I don't think we should assume that this means kind of the classic forms of Christianity are on their way back in any way. I think what we're seeing is some of the drive that what's always been there, I think, at least since the late 60s, has been a desire to be the kind of person that has some spiritual component to you. But often we didn't have enough time to do that. And now all of a sudden, you're forced, some people at least, are forced to be at home. And for the first time, you can actually read that meditation book and try meditating. And so it's no wonder then they report that they feel that. The interesting thing is to look at that now. I think that we've seen an interesting, I think this is true with pastors too. I think that the first 3 months of the pandemic were a pastoral practice revolution. I think that overall that pastors really rose to the occasion and did new things. And I think then by August, my experience has been a lot of people's congregations turned on them and were frustrated and they were burnt out. And now here we go into the fall and we don't know when anything like normal is going to happen. And people are angry there's not going to be a Christmas, and they blame you that they're not going to have Christmas. And you have to somehow negotiate that. So I think we're, I think there's openings for the spiritual reality, but I think there's also ways that it can spin back on us. So I think we have to take advantage of that, but also be aware of that and are kind of living that.
Andy, go ahead.
No, Jared, go for it. I can hold on to mine.
Okay. Well, I just thought of a couple different deep longings that this pandemic might be pointing people toward. So I thought of the, obviously, when we come to grips with our own mortality, when there's an empty seat at the dinner table, or someone who we went to work with who we hadn't seen since the pandemic started passes away, anytime we're faced with our own mortality, we start asking deeper questions about meaning and purpose. Times when we're separated from one another and we feel intense loneliness. I think of some people who for months and months didn't even feel like they could leave their apartment because they were in hot spots in the country. In some cases, if they didn't have a spouse or kids or what have you, there was just deep longing for community. I think of, there are some in-person face-to-face classes with masks on here at Baylor this semester. And when we tried to organize an event that was a masks-only event, people responded within the day, and most of them said yes, because just something about embodied presence, they found themselves longing deeply for. So I think there's just some deeper yearnings, the yearning for community, the yearning for meaning in the face of one's mortality. I think there have been these little glimpses of transcendence. So I think of the city of Jalandhar in India. It had been decades since people had seen the Himalayas. So there are these moments where people, even at the global level, I think of the return of animals in national parks who hadn't been seen or heard from for quite a long time. So there's these glimpses of transcendence that people in their busyness, harriedness, just in the machinery of globalism might have not been able to glimpse. Then I also, deep racial injustice will bring communities that are marginalized and disenfranchised together in ways, even if they can't be physically present with one another. There's, of course, a call to prayer, a call to action, an emphasis on community, an emphasis on being family for one another, not just because there's a global pandemic, but because there's a racial injustice pandemic. So I just see lots of points of convergence with how that would touch down on a deeper longing for issues of spirituality and faith. Sorry to interrupt you, Kenyatta. Go for it.
No worries. So I was just going to follow up on, actually ask a question, since Andy is somewhat in the field of youth ministry, the North Star. And so this pandemic certainly affects the way in which we engage our children. And trying to, you cannot take for granted that on the continuum of spiritual maturity, that your children will appreciate what you appreciate. And so I'm wondering, what are some of the strategies that you would commend, Andy, for children in this period of pandemic? As Jared mentioned, that this is an opportunity for many of us to do more interior probing and reflection. But, I have grade school children, and, a sense of routine is important to them. Social outreach is important to them. So there's spiritual tension, but how does that get resolved or addressed in the home of a preacher or home of a pastor? Those are some of the things that are a bit concerning for to me at this point. So,
I think with all of this, there's such a dynamic of gains and losses, and it feels like one of the gains, particularly for kind of middle class, overly committed families, that when the pandemic arrived again in the first 3 months, there was deep grief. There's deep grief that the baseball season that you had prepared, the senior year baseball season you prepared for your kids since they were 11, all of a sudden was just gone. Or, you know, going, you know, you wanted to go to Baylor your whole life, and then you find out, you know, I don't know if this is true at Baylor, but that, you know, all of a sudden students were going back on campus and you're going to be in your parents' basement at school. Like those were, I think, deep pains for particularly middle-class families, but it also provided a space for people to actually eat dinner together and have conversations instead of racing from one practice to the other. So I think there's been real, I know, at least speaking for my family, like there's been a real opportunity for us to spend time together that we never have before and to take on new practices. And then at the same time, we want to kill each other more because I just want my kids out of my house. And, you know, especially when it comes to like this time of day where they're just eating up the bandwidth as they're, you know, on their own Zoom calls. And both of my kids, for very different reasons, need to be in school. You know, my daughter just needs social connection. She needs people. She breaks down a couple of times a week that she can't be at school with her friends. My son doesn't need people at all, which is why he actually needs to be in school, because he can go into the hole of his computer and never come out for weeks. So, you know, every kid's different, let alone every family, but there are chances again to slow down. But this is the great work I think preachers do and pastoral leaders do, is that here's a chance to slow down, but slow down for what? There's gotta be a deeper sense, and there's gotta be a deeper horizon, even a different moral vision of what this slowing down is for, you know? So we've seen a lot of moves even before the pandemic of slow food and slow church and like a move towards the kind of more slower pace. And that is really good and really helpful, but there's still a need for us to connect. I would think a deeper theological connection of what's the slowdown for. And the human spirit needs to slow down, but the human spirit also needs to be directed towards some horizon bigger than us that takes us outside of ourselves. And so I think this is a moment where, you know, back to Matt's question, the spirituality was there. People needed to slow down, and they felt something they hadn't before. And I think in some ways they felt the deep injustices they were sometimes too busy to feel before or wanted to care about, but never, but they just had to keep going. They just had to keep on the treadmill. But now we still have to deal with the fact of, okay, for what? What's the moral horizon here? What's the bigger thing we're being called into? And that makes what people are doing who are watching this really, really important. That's even right. If it is looking at a red or a green dot, that man, what you do is really, really important that way.
Mm. Sorry, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, Kenyatta, because it does, it pulls out the same response from me in terms of what are we being? To piggyback on Andy's recognition that the grind of life has shifted. And what were we on this treadmill for? Why were we running this race? And the slowing down to be able to attend to our spirit and spiritual reality, our identity, leans over into your question in slowing down to actually be the immediate community that is where we learn how to be community, family. And what does it mean to recover that sense of being the ones who lean the story and who teach the story and then teach us how to value the relationships and how we interact with one another? So if the way that we interact with one another is to say, go to your room, then when we do get out in the world, how do you deal with someone you disagree with? You shove them out of your space, or you leave their space. And one of the things that I think that has been exposed right now is the brokenness of our systems, which we can and rightly need to name as sexism and particularly racism. But the reality is that system of inhospitality is bad for everyone. And so two things I think have been exposed in the response of one, when folks got angry, or Andy, as you said, when the people in the church get angry at the pastor because we can't have Christmas, and they riot or they protest, And yeah, I'm using those words because of the power that they invoke. When people have that reaction, isn't that just what African Americans have been how we've been responding to oppression, loss of agency, being controlled all these years? And so when this happens, because this system was in place, it othered those who didn't fit into our moneyed, military-powered male of European descent privilege. If you weren't in that category, then the system had a way of oppressing you. Well, all of a sudden, that system is working against the people who thought that system didn't. That's because the system is working perfectly. And I think the slowing down right now, And I know this is a challenging way to end this question, but I think the challenge for us right now is to recognize my personal frustration, my personal anger, whoever I am, whatever identity I claim, how does that help me be empathetic to other people who have a sense of loss, a sense of oppression, a sense of fragility? And maybe I can see their humanity now because I'm recognizing, wow, sometimes I want to be angry and hit something too. I think that's been exposed in this moment too. And I think the church would do well to have the language to help folks find a sense of community, especially with those we thought weren't in our community.
I was preaching at a church here in Waco about a week and a half ago. And most of my preaching over the last, 8 months or 7 months has been to a green dot in an empty room. But this is a church that meets outdoors. It's a church that draws people who have addictions, who have mental illness. It's called Church Under the Bridge. They can't meet under the bridge right now because there's construction under the bridge. So they have to meet somewhere else. I'm preaching outdoors, a train's going by with a loud whistle. Someone with mental illness is up front on the worship team, even though he's not on the worship team. Some people are on something. Some people are talking to each other. And the mess of it all reminded me that this is what families are actually like. So that metaphor, that idea that shows up of the church as a family, I think of Joseph Hellerman's book, When the Church Was a Family. A lot of people think about the church as a corporation now.
Right.
When the church was a family, there was much more of an openness to the mess. Some of the church services I went to with family in Honduras, there was kind of that messiness to it as well, where people were coming in and out, someone was breastfeeding, someone was doing this, someone was doing that. There wasn't necessarily a piece of paper that, you knew exactly what was going to come next. I don't know. There's something about this pandemic that exposes reality for people. And some of the pastors, preachers that I've talked to, sometimes they'll actually incorporate the mess into their video sermon from home, right? Like, a family member's walking by behind them and the cat jumps up or whatever. There's a reason I have the door locked. but you get what I mean. Like there's something about the mess of it all that can even bridge that clergy-laity divide where people know that the pastor is very much a human being too, with messiness in family as well, trying to do the best that they can right now as well. And there's just something that I think is strangely beautiful about that.
Somebody commented about the importance of gathered community where you're known in the midst of all of this, that yes, you can listen to the top preacher in the land, whoever you understand that to be on the web, but people still want to come back to the preacher who knows their name and to the community where they're known. And so how that fits too. That was, I think, a really important comment. And so how even with this life of screens now that we find ways where preaching can nourish community, which I think means that some of our sermons are best given sitting at a chair, with the pets running around, that the medium has so changed Just like a written sermon is never the same as a spoken sermon, or a videotaped sermon is different than an audio sermon, there's something about this moment. There are only about 5 minutes left, believe it or not, so I'm going to, you need to answer this last one somewhat rapidly. But it's this. People sometimes come to preaching conferences. It's like going to camp back when you were a kid and you come back all fired up for Jesus and everything's going to change. But you come to a preaching conference and you resolve to make changes in your craft, or you're inspired by a vision of justice and you're going to weave that into your preaching, or you've got now a sense of what you want to do over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, all of those things that are important parts of the work. Given your experience, all four of you, what advice would you give to preachers about what a realistic rate of change might look like and how to stay motivated toward whatever the goals are that they might be setting for themselves as a result of these 3 days? I'll give you a minute each. We'll start with Jerry because he hasn't gone first yet once, I don't think.
Okay. I'll try to go fast. Now, of course, there's the divine agency things, practices of interiority, ways that we can grow spiritually. That can make up for a lot of our own foibles, weaknesses, inabilities as communicators. I think of Augustine on Christian teaching. Our life can be an abundant source of eloquence. So there are ways that we can adjudicate our own limitations through practices in which we go deeper with God. Deep exegesis arises from a deep person. So that's that part. The human agency part, I think of K. Anders Ericsson's studies on practice and expertise, someone who's been practicing medicine or driving or fill in the blank for 20 years could actually be worse than they were when they started, or worse than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The key difference that's made is an emphasis on deliberate practice over just automatic practice. And deliberate practice is characterized by these four commitments: risk-taking, concrete goals, focused attention, which is more just like trying to interrogate the actual event of preaching, even as we think about it and reflect on it, and then constructive feedback. So other people speaking into my life. So the temptation would be to make a rapid change, you know, like here's how my preaching needs to change immediately. A part of Erickson's larger point is that those who focus on deliberate practice won't be worse off 5 years later. They'll grow into, with a growth mindset, they'll grow into the people that they're called to be, whether that's as drivers or medicine, doctors, or in our case, as preachers.
Thank you. Kenyatta, you ready?
Okay.
No, you are now.
No, because the distance from one another as professional colleagues is not as much of a factor, because we can Zoom now with clergy across the nation and even internationally. I think this might be a good time to fortify those relationships with those we've been wanting to over the course of our career. So I just really think that this is a great time to do more collaborative work and to pre-plan to do that with persons we respect in ministry. Of course, I think we are all, even though it's not been a full year yet, but we are exhausted on Zoom. I mean, it takes a lot. But I do think that there are opportunities there to mentor one another online. One of the things that I seek to do in my own ministry, aside from what I do in the academy and at Howard, is to bring together mentoring relationships with clergy who are esteemed in the culture, in ways in which folks who are serving underrepresented or impoverished communities will have opportunities perhaps to engage in ways in which they would not if they were going to a conference, physically leaving their space.
How about you, Andy, and then Joy, you can take us home.
Yeah, Yeah, I think, you know, you leave a conference and you said your point, Matt, about, you know, camp, and you're thrilled by that, or you're exhausted. You have major Zoom fatigue, one or the other. But I think, you know, the practice to take, and it seems so counterintuitive, but is, I think, really necessary, is to wait. I mean, we're in a time where we're forced to wait. In some ways, we'll never get back to anything like normal again. But if we get back to even be able to have Christmas, it'll probably be waiting for a vaccine to come. But I think there's also a deep kind of theological commitment to waiting. And if we are people who need to be saved, and we need a God who saves us, then a God who is God, we can't control this God's action. So the action we have to take is to wait for this God. And I'm just reminded of the late 19th century preacher, Christoph Blumhardt, who wrote a little book called Hastened Waiting, and really making the argument that the Christian life is one of action. You do things, and we have to take actions for justice and to care for people who are hurting. But there is a sense of waiting in the midst of that, and giving presence as we wait for God to come and to save us. So I think, you know, as we move back into whatever life will be, we need to help people wait and wait for God to come and to move. And so I think if you could leave this conference learning to wait, that would be huge for yourself, your ministry, and I think for all of us.
Wow, you should have went last. That is so true. I think I'm going to say what I'm guilty of always saying. This sort of leans into the idea of we have this accessible sermons that folks can come back to because they can upload it or download it or click on it. And therefore, to take the time to walk through the story, to plan out a series of sermons that says, what is it that if you come to church for a year, what should you know about the biblical storied revelation of God? And to do that, not out of God is good, God is big, God is savior, God is creator, but to say, let me tell you what folks have said about God in this book and see how God is revealed. And that would be the challenge, I would say. Leave this conference saying, in the reality of a world that has a different story, politics, our various identities, our fragility because of the moment, let's tell the alternative story that has been passed down to us in Scripture through the ages. It's been life-giving for generations before us, and if we share it well, it'll be there for those after us, if we have to wait for the return of Jesus.
Thank you. I want to thank all four of you for your wisdom, for your gifts, for your time, for your candor. Really quickly, Andy, what was the book that you mentioned?
I don't know.
You said late 19th century.
Oh, a book called, it's called Hastened Waiting by Christoph Blumhardt.
Hastened Waiting. And I see from Kenyatta also a book by Leah Shada, Preaching in the Purple Zone. There it is. Kenyatta receives no royalties for that.
No, this, Matt, to a question that I received yesterday about, you know, just the cost that one would pay in preaching in a prophetic mode. I think Leah's book, speaking to a congregation where you clearly have partisanship divide. I think it's a great strategy book for folk to pick up.
That is good to know. Another question that was posted was, what is the one book you personally would carry through the portal in addition to your Bible? And so if you want to put that in the chat to all the attendees, you can. We are a little bit over time, but in about 10 and a half minutes, worship will begin, I believe, in this very same space. And our preacher will be the Reverend Dr. Joy J. Moore. Again, thank you to the four of you, and get ready. And log off if you need to, or just come right back in 10 minutes.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.